When we think of mysticism, we usually associate it strictly with the development of religious teachings. But looking around us in our modern way of life, we shall find considerable evidence of the continuance of mystical ideas and ideals in the more common institutions and procedures and practices with which we are familiar. Therefore, it seems appropriate to realize that mysticism is not a sect, nor must it develop within the structure of sects. Mysticism is an overtone which bears upon many forms of life, many activities. Actually, mysticism is almost as difficult to capture as an adequate definition of beauty. Beauty is a sort of product arising from other products. It is a byproduct. It comes to us as a result of order, arrangement, of the power of the individual to perceive from within himself the unities and values that exist beneath the surface of various types of phenomena. In our modern thinking, therefore, mysticism is a quality to be found in the lives of innumerable persons, developed variously according to the nature and temperament of individuals, and also permeating and penetrating many fields of life where you would not immediately expect it to be present. Looking around us today, therefore, we can begin to recognize our indebtedness to mystical concepts and ideas. A brief historical survey may help to orient us in this. At the time of the Crusades, mysticism moved from the Near East into Europe with a tremendous impact. Mysticism arose among the Islamic peoples at a time when their culture was reaching its golden age of flowering. It was transferred from the soil of Asia to the soil of Southern and Central Europe at a time when European culture was at a very low ebb. During this period, which we often call the Dark Ages or the early medieval world, European man was so far removed from ethical experiences as we know them that he lived within an extremely narrow boundary of religious and political literalisms. Everything had to be accepted upon its face value. There was no inquiry into the more subtle factors in beliefs or ideas. During this period in Europe, no important texts were written. Very little, if anything, came to us to bear witness of originality in men's thinking. It was only after this time, with the breakthrough of the Renaissance, that medieval man, enriched by Near Eastern mystical attitudes, began to move forward into what we call modern culture. Thus, we know that the Renaissance, although generally and traditionally believed to have originated in the area of Constantinople, actually represented a broad mystical tradition. It brought imagination back into the life of the individual. It caused him to recapture the spirit of dreaming that had been lost with the collapse of Greco-Latin culture. In the rise of Renaissance man, we find the individual daring to derive inspiration from within himself. For many centuries, he had leaned completely upon institutional inspiration. He believed that in the vested clergy there existed a body of men divinely anointed to think, to lead, to believe, and to teach. Those not belonging to this group developed incredible inferiority complexes about their own merit and their own achievement. And we had a time mutilated with this tremendous sense of personal sin, the shortcoming of the average mortal, his inability to have any part or place in the framing of his own destiny. With mysticism returning to Europe, we find the rise of individualism, the rise of the individual whose source of courage and of certainty lay within his own convictions, locked perhaps by inadequate instruments in his own intellectual limitation, but nevertheless present as a powerful urge toward self-expressiveness. The individual began to think of himself as having a direct relationship with God and with nature and with life. Although it might seem to be a complete contradiction, mysticism in Europe led very strongly to the rise of natural sciences. Mysticism caused the individual to question the authorities of Avicenna and Galen and Aquinas, to question formula as the solution to problems. Mysticism was opposed to authoritarianism. It was opposed to the idea that some other person could be an infallible source of knowledge. It also helped the individual to liberate his mind from the authority of centuries, the authority of creeds or sects. It was a breaking through of a spontaneous inner life, long repressed, long held, and finally creating a terrific interior revolt in man. It was impossible longer to prevent this breaking through of the torrent of submerged individuality. At this time, the breakthrough was comparatively peaceful, inasmuch as the mystic is not a person of violence. This breakthrough was a kind of an aurora, or a dawn light, a rosy glow coming in the sky to promise the coming of a better day. This rise of the Son of Man, this rise of the light of the soul, moved throughout Europe and brought with it innumerable reforms and changes, many of which are directly behind institutions and attitudes that we now regard as normal and commonplace. I would say, therefore, that from science to modern religion, there is practically no organized group that has not been influenced strongly by a mystical equation, although this mysticism may no longer appear as a spiritual instrument. It may appear merely as a cultural or aesthetic instrument. In our thinking about these situations, we must also pause for a moment to give some note to the rise of mystical fraternities and mystics as individuals during the early modern period. We know, for example, the tremendous psychological importance of the rise of the Fraternity of the Rosy Cross in the early years of the 17th century. Here we had a group of Protestant mystics, probably rooted in Lutheranism, but individuals with the vision of utopian hope of future conditions that might prevail in society, and in turn giving inspiration to a whole tribe of utopians who have never ceased to envision a better state for man. We have the mysticism of Jacob Böhme, the German shoemaker, whose works have continued, particularly through the instrumentality of his disciple Gichtel. The works of Böhme are still read and still considered and there are small groups representing his spiritual convictions. At about this time also, we see the rise of the Lutheran reformer André, whose mysticism impelled him to create unions and trade groups to improve labor conditions in Europe. Early mysticism in Europe seems to have turned almost immediately to utilities, and behind nearly all of its pressures were the instincts for human betterment, fraternity, equality, and liberty. Thus, your mystics became your patriots and contributed much to the freedom of nations and to the rise of religious tolerance among the peoples of the Western culture group. Now, mysticism, rising from these roots, moved directly into a number of rather recognizable channels. We had a whole group of mystical religious sects, not as clearly defined as most other theologies, but representing themselves through such organizations as the Friends and the Quakers and the various groups of Adventists that flourished in the 17th and 18th centuries. Through William Penn and the Pietists of provincial Pennsylvania, a powerful link was established between European mysticism and the opening of our Western Hemisphere to colonization. William Penn, as a man of integrity, of enlightened leadership, fair play, and powerful internal conscience, was able to accomplish a great deal in solving the difficulties between the colonials and the American Indian groups. Penn and others of his general quality were to be found among many of the early settlers and resulted in a rise of mysticism in this country at a comparatively early date. We can find dates as early as the late years of the 17th century that mysticism was actually moved to the Western Hemisphere. Mystical sects and cults have continued, as in Western Pennsylvania, where the Order of the Woman of the Wilderness and the Fraternity of the Mustard Seed represented strange but basic mystical foundations. In addition to these kinds of movements, we see mysticism emerging into our cultural life as a result of these overtones that have been captured on the level of creative artistry. Today, probably, the principal instruments of mysticism in our daily way of living are the various branches of the fine arts. Here we have continuous emphasis upon spiritual experience. I think one of the most important of these groups of experiences are now associated with music. Music has always been a peculiarly intimate experience in the life of the individual. Music is a universal language. It requires very little of the ordinary restrictions of communication forms with which we are so burdened. The music speaks no verbal language. It rather goes directly into the perception of man as in experience. And it is gratifying and important to realize that great music is now returning strongly to our people. This return is undoubtedly motivated by the psychological need within man himself. It represents his instinctive recognition that music nourishes a part of his nature which is otherwise without adequate support. The majority of your great musicians of the past have been, if not mystics, strongly influenced by mysticism. We may include in such a list Bach, Beethoven, Wagner, Scriabin, and many others. This recognition of mystical equation, we also note in the rise of such groups of music as the Wagnerian operas, where not only the music itself, but the themes are very largely drawn from religious or symbolic sources. The great ring operas of Wagner certainly represent a restoration of Nordic mythology and Germanic myths. On the other hand, the study of Wagner reveals to us clearly that he did not merely accept the sagas and Eddas that had descended from tradition. He took these various symbolic forms and infused them with a metapolitical concept of his own. Wagner was therefore a creator of myths. He created a mythology around a mythology. And the more we analyze his music dramas, the more convinced we become that he gave a tremendous mystical creativity to stories which had previously lacked these powerful overtones. He also applied these symbols and these mysticisms to the prevailing problems of his time. And as we know, even during his own life, he was in political difficulties on several occasions. Music has become one of the most important forms of therapy with which we have sought to counteract the extreme materialistic expressions of our time. For many persons today, music is their only experience of mysticism. We say this fully aware that the music lover may not even be aware or conscious that such is the case. But music accomplishes much of the mood of mystical meditation. First of all, in order to enjoy great music, we must become receptive. We cannot attack music. We must allow music to have its perfect works in us. We must be prepared to be receptive, to allow the harmonic chords and patterns to create their own interpretation in our natures. Thus, music can be wonderfully and subtly adapted to our own moods, and we instinctively seek out music that is consoling, comforting, inspiring, encouraging, relaxing, according to the nature of our own immediate requirement. Thus, while music may seem to be a very simple and obvious art, actually, it has within it a tremendous power to change the psychic integration of the individual. It moves in upon him, creating a series of experiences. The music lover must pass through a series of degrees of personal unfoldment. His taste in music must mature with his understanding of the principles of harmony and musical composition. Also, music is an experience in law. For under the beautiful coating and covering of grand harmony and melody, music moves with absolute precision. Music is as relentless and inevitable as the motion of the heavens. Every part of it must be adequately, mathematically defined. And the great musician may compose apparently with great ease and rapidity, although some have not been so facile in this regard. Actually, however, whether it is intuition, whether it is the labored genius of long experience, the great musical composition is a document that is essentially valid. It is valid in terms of eternal facts. The musician dealing with rates of vibration must handle them adequately and properly, or the result is discord. He cannot permit himself to break through the essential rules of his art. He is therefore creating within law and order. He is expressing within the legal boundaries of the harpsichord, the violin, or the piano. He is moving according to true creativity. He is not merely producing as whim dictates. He is producing as law and order require. He is taking certain original themes. He is developing them according to principles and rules that are comparatively inflexible. So out of this experience, we have sheer beauty. But this sheer beauty is sustained by immutable law. This lesson itself is of the greatest importance to us, inasmuch as it reminds us forever that all beauty and all harmony arise from obedience, that the individual is great to the degree that he uses laws wisely, and he loses his greatness when he breaks the rules governing the art or science with which he is concerned. We note the rise of greater music criticism on the part of the general public, the distribution of good music, attendance to great music. These are increasing every day, and they certainly tell us that man is discovering soul hunger. He is discovering the need for an aesthetic expression that combines the acceptance of beauty with a deep, reflective, devotional attitude. As most Western peoples know nothing about meditation or the contemplative arts of the East, it is good that they should have music as a way to create a kind of meditation. They find in great music most of the experiences of mysticism. In fact, we even have numerous records of music leading toward direct and definite musical experience on a mystical level. We have reports of individuals absorbed in listening to a great composition suddenly see the orchestra and the entire involved area burst into light, to see the entire musical composition unfolding as a great geometrical pattern in space, producing an artistry which would almost defy man's greatest ambition to depict such a scene with the humble colors available on an artist's palette. Mystics also have perceived or known music as a tremendous vibratory motion moving through themselves. They have found themselves to be picked up in harmony and to be lifted out of the commonplace and the everyday. There are many persons who find in music, therefore, a form of religious devotion, a devotion that is based upon a symbolic acceptance of cosmic music moving in upon them. They have, to a sense at least, become aware of the music of the spheres, of the music of space, of the music of universal law. They have recognized a universe of harmony. And that is exactly what the mystic experiences in his meditation. He perceives the universe unfold into light, color, and sound. He perceives these divine forces, which he has adored with his closed and covered senses, suddenly revealed to him in the splendor of sound and the majesty of form. Thus, symbols arising from within the individual give expression to the instincts and emotions that are locked within him. It is good to observe the improvement in music, and also it is good to observe, from a standpoint of our general information, how individuals not possessing this type of consciousness have permitted themselves to become involved in non-melodic or inharmonic music. We also observe the rise of syncopations in various forms and the innumerable modern music forms, which are not entirely satisfactory from the standpoint of great art. In fact, I think that's a bit of an understatement. But then we feel very kind and benevolent this evening, and therefore do not wish to hurt anyone. But the essential fact is that music of a discordant nature, music in which we find no aesthetic value or satisfaction, but which seemingly becomes a stimulant, we see the same type of situation as between nutrition and stimulation. The individual who is wise and who is a little run down will certainly work with nutrition, but if he is quite wise, he will refrain so far as he can from stimulants. He will realize that a stimulant gives him a pickup without contributing anything to his basic improvement. The continual use of the stimulant also results in habit-forming situations and the gradual loss of its effect. Thus, music forms that are dissonant and are essentially intended for stimulation purposes must continually change, must intensify their rhythms, must become more and more clashing in their discords in order to produce the so-called stimulating effect. We have observed this also in the gradual motion of jazz from a comparatively innocuous form to one which is almost pure stimulation to jagged and ragged nerves. The individual becoming more nervous thinks he feels better, but he does not actually gain any improvement from this type of stimulation. Nutrition, on the other hand, is the feeding of value within the person. It is supplying the individual with the essential materials necessary for the sustaining of a true attitude under the pressure of circumstances. Music gives the individual available internal resources, making him more aware of internals, giving him a greater experience of what peace of soul can be, also to discover the tremendous vitality of relaxing to harmony, to opening oneself to true order, to true harmony of sound. As a result of this type of situation, many persons who have very little musical ability of their own become exceedingly exacting in their selection of music. A person who is listening to music merely because he needs the nutrition of it in his soul can be music's most complete critic. The critic for the daily paper has a certain sophistication. He is not listening. He wishes he was elsewhere, but he has to be there to cover the concert. His criticism is based upon purely technical productions and can sometimes be brutally heartless. He has destroyed many a career simply because he was not where he wanted to be at that time. This type of criticism is not valid, but the individual who has opened himself to the healing power of music can feel a certain type of dissonance strike into him, can cause him to detect some major error or flaw in the performance because it begins to hurt him, because he finds that this stream of blessedness has been interrupted. He may not know how or why, but he is quick to discern its effect upon his own nature, and therefore quick to observe if the error is repeated. And I know individuals who have never studied a musical score who accurately pointed out every flaw in a concert. They knew nothing about it, they cared nothing about flaws, but they winced when they occurred. They were simply too sensitive in their receptivity to be able to accept a dissonance without reaction, without sensing that something had been outraged in their own contemplative attitude toward music. With music, we come upon other branches of arts, one of which I think also calls for some thought. And now we come to the fine arts, such as painting and sculpturing. In the fine arts, the world in the last several centuries has not been particularly fortunate in the production of mystical genius. Our whole Western way of life in art history has not been essentially mystical. building our art concepts and canons from the Greco-Roman schools, we have always glorified form predominantly. To us, art has been the representation of the outer surfaces of things. Our art has been a copying of certain aspects of nature, with special emphasis in the West upon man and upon the studies of the human figure as it has attracted art and artists for many hundreds of years. As a result of this particular emphasis, we have become almost photographic in our art. The traditional and academic forms are perhaps more dominantly so. But our rebellion against traditional and academic schools of art, this rebellion has not been fortunate. It was not fortunate because we now find the individual placed in a different situation. The music lover listens. He accepts. He receives into himself art as impact. The creative artist, whether the composer or the painter, has a different relationship to art. To him, art expresses impulse. It is the release of himself into some art form or art medium. In the Western world, we have not had sufficient emphasis upon the cultivation of mysticism per se, mysticism in itself. As a result of that, most of our artists were themselves not mystics. Now, an artist can be great within the field of his own activity without being an essential mystic. We do not question the greatness of Michelangelo. We do not question the greatness of Rembrandt or Peter Paul Rubens. We know these men from an artistic standpoint were masters within their own fields. Yet, generally speaking, they were not mystics. And even when they chose a religious subject, this religious subject gained a strange realism, a strange literalism, until the various sanctified persons seemed to be brought down to earth and made into very earthy beings. Art in the West was always dragging ideas and symbols down to earth and giving them forms or bodies of an earthy quality or kind. Having thus brought heaven to earth, the only remedy that the artist had to restore heaven to its proper place was to place a halo around the head of some earthly representation. Therefore, first he took a divine being and caused a model to pose for this divine being. And then, having achieved as the result of his artistry only a human being and not the likeness of a divine being, he wanted to explain this, what he really meant, to other people who would never discover it otherwise. Therefore, he put a halo around the head to indicate that it was a divine being. Whereupon everyone who saw it said, "My, this is a sanctified person." But the sanctification had to be labeled. And this has been true of most Western art. It has never been able to escape into the sheer creative imagery by means of which it was able to give to the one who gazes upon it the complete impact of unworldliness. Western man has for a long time cultivated worldliness, and it shows pretty well even in his most unworldly efforts. Against the background of this general worldliness, we do find a few artists who have broken through into what might be termed mystical artistry. Perhaps the greatest in more recent times to achieve this end were the English artists William Blake and Watts. Watts was one of the greatest painters of England ever produced. The Watts Gallery in London is devoted almost exclusively to the mystical works of this man. Blake, of course, was a tremendous creative genius, a genius to break through the conventional roles and patterns of things, a skilled etcher, engraver, and painter. He was a tremendous student of Michelangelo. But he went far more into art in the standpoint of pure mysticism than his master. Of course, Blake did not actually study with Michelangelo, who lived much earlier, but he was greatly addicted to the works of Michelangelo. Blake had a peculiar religious, mystical philosophy of his own, apart from art. He used his mysticism as the impulse behind his art, and many of his choicest artworks are illustrations to his own mystical writings. Today we know of Blake as an artist, but very few persons know of him as a writer or as a mystic. Nor do they realize how he cooperated with Thomas Paine to contribute considerable assistance to the rise of American independence. It was the mystic type of mind that saw in the experiment of the 13 original colonies one of the most important movements toward the release of the internal life of man. Now, there were other artists also. Possibly the name that stands out among the classic painters for mystical overtones is El Greco. Here was one artist that broke away tremendously from the literal, who began to sense the importance of life moving through form. The form was merely a symbol, and that to deify the symbol was to obscure the life. So El Greco began to sacrifice form for life. And this has always been one of the great indications of the creative artist, particularly on the higher levels of mysticism. The difference between Eastern and Western art is very largely this matter of mysticism. We know, for example, the names of many of the old beggars and poor relations that posed for Rembrandt van Rijn at various times in his career. We know that he had a wonderful skill to drape some old fisherman or ancient from the community in strange, bizarre clothing and transform him into an Oriental nabob of some nature. Plus the tremendous impact of the Rembrandt lighting technique, we have much of the genius of this master. In the East, however, it is rare, if ever, that a great artist will ever use a model for any reason. He is not making pictures of bodies. This does not mean that he has not studied anatomy, or that he is unable to draw a body correctly. It means, however, that the forms which he intends or desires to use have first moved out of the world into himself. He has stored away in his own consciousness the essential knowledge of draftsmanship. He has put away where he can find it when he needs it certain impressions of forms. He can draw almost anything that he wishes to draw from memory. This is the beginning of art from inside, for memory inevitably passes through certain conditions within the consciousness of the artist. An example of this will be found in the wonderful prints of Hiroshige. This interior conditioning causes an ocean to become a different kind of an ocean, a wave to become a different kind of a wave. It causes a flower to be more than a flower. And it causes the human body to be merely the shadow of a purpose or an idea. Thus the bodies of things are subordinated to their moods, to their motions, to the qualities which it is intended that they should betray or that they should reveal. In Oriental art, consequently, there is an otherworldness almost always apparent. The connoisseur of art, the individual who has a great and growing and steadily unfolding appreciation for the nobility of art value, slowly comes to appreciate this fact that art, in the unworldliness of the Eastern technicians, becomes truly creative. It is not even dependent upon nature, except very indefinitely and indirectly. It is the artist impelling the spectator to perceive value, to receive a kind of message, a message cunningly concealed in design, a message also that requires no word for its communication. Thus, in Eastern art, we frequently discover the peculiar lack of involvement, the simplicity of no tab. We see the essential elements, and the rest is left to the imagination. The Eastern, contrary to the Western, does not indoctrinate. He is constantly coaxing the person who sees the work to release himself into it, to give himself greater opportunity to feel and to complete a design or pattern. It is not generally known that European artists, even the greatest of them, usually worked in groups, which are sometimes referred to as workshops. In these workshops, several men of sometimes a great talent collaborated on various paintings. For example, one man would do nothing but faces. Another man would do nothing but drapery. And a third man would do nothing but scenic backgrounds. We know, consequently, that in a work such as the Mona Lisa, the man who painted the face did not paint the background. Even a man of the skill of Leonardo was a specialist. And in many instances, the master merely added the final touches to the works of his disciples. But even where the master himself intended the work as a serious production of his own, he cooperated with others. And the portraitist and the scenic artist were two entirely different types of skill. In the Orient, this is not true. The individual paints all of his picture. He must have, therefore, the sense of both foreground and background. And in the Orient, there is the curious trick of often subordinating the foreground to the background, so that the background really moves forward to become the dominant note. And wherever this is accomplished, it is achieved without the sense of conflict that often arises in Western painting, where one is sacrificed to the other. The Oriental artist, because of his technique and because of his own natural mysticism, paints almost, as one of the old masters said, upon silk clouds. Instead of painting on the piece of silk in front of him, he paints first in a cloud in his own consciousness. He fashions an imaginary panel of silk. He visualizes it until he sees it clearly. He then proceeds to place upon this his design, arranging it and rearranging it, perhaps 1,000 times with his own interior visualization, before he ever touches brush to physical material. Thus the painting is finished before it is drawn. And it is only the transference of this finished product to its final visible medium that concerns the artist. It would be inevitable that some such a process should have to distinguish Eastern and Western arts because of the materials in which the two groups painted. To paint in tempera, or in oil, or even in watercolor, according to Western technique, is far simpler than the Eastern way. And we observe in x-raying pictures and in cleaning them many layers of overpainting, in which an artist, for example, may move the position of a hand three times before he finally decides exactly where he wants it. This is impossible in the East, where you are painting upon fragile silk and where no correction of any kind can be made. This means that the work must be exactly as intended. Not even a single stroke can be widened or deepened. Not a single correction can be made in a line. It must appear in its finished form immediately. Kobo Daishi, the great Japanese Buddhist artist, painted with 10 brushes simultaneously and was able to do this without making a single false stroke. Now, many individuals would say that this requires consummate skill, that the way it is done is to keep on making strokes until you have filled thousands of pieces of silk and thrown them away, and until you have become complete master of making the strokes. This is not the Eastern way, however. The Eastern way is that all of this experimentation shall be done interiorly. It is done within the consciousness of the artist himself. He subjects his entire body to the discipline of the purposes of his mind. And he brings the mind into such complete control of the body that he produces a miracle that almost corresponds with the Western miracle of the great artist on the piano. Here the fingers move so rapidly that it would not seem that the mind can possibly control them. In the Oriental painter, the hand moves with absolute skill, simply because it is fulfilling an archetypal concept that is fully and entirely complete. It is rare indeed that the Eastern master has to discard a painting because he has made an error. It is the complete discipline of creativity. It is not mechanical, it is visualization. It is the power to so completely see a thing within ourselves that there can be no need for any change afterwards. It is already as perfect as our genius will permit. Thus art becomes a tremendous instrument in mysticism. We know that in theology it has been used for centuries for the dissemination of religious knowledge. In many countries, the church depends heavily upon paintings for communicating religious ideas. It depends upon religious drama for the edification of a populace, which is perhaps illiterate. But we must never assume that an individual, though he may be illiterate, is without the capacity to grasp through some inner faculties important truths if they are presented to his consideration. So we have in art another profound instrument of the perpetuation of mysticism. And the great struggle of art today is not so different from the struggle of music. For what we term today syncopation in music, or the various schools of jazz, have their art correspondences in painting in our various schools of modern impressionism and post-impressionism and cubism and these types of artistic endeavors. We find there also the struggle of the individual to break away from literal things, to break away from copying, from photography, from the actual representation of nature. Yet in order to break successfully, the individual must have outgrown the level from which he is seeking to separate his consciousness. A violent revolution against matter does not lead to emancipation. It leads only to deformity or distortion as a means of escape. There is no escape in art or in mysticism through breaking the laws of color or formal harmony. The escape must always be by outgrowing the poor use of an instrument and the development of a greater interior power to use that instrument for the expression of creative genius. Therefore, rebellion unaccompanied by genius produces the rather sad spectacle with which we are all too familiar. To be different is not to be better. But it cannot be said that an individual can be better without being a little different. Thus, the equation is extremely subtle. In addition to our arts and our music, we have a certain amount of creative mysticism in our dance interpretations. These interpretations, based upon mystical themes, such as the works of Mahler and Bruckner, give us the opportunity of using choreography as a means of expressing our natural reaction to musical stimulation, or the musical moods or modes which accompany certain compositions. This is not only the refinement of the modal music of the Greeks, but it is also an approach to the mudra, which is the posturing or religious hand positions of Asia. In the East, the body becomes a tremendous instrument of dynamic symbolism. By posturing, by various positions of the hands, by various gestures, sometimes referred to in the East as the art of gesture, the individual communicates, he conveys. He is able to release or reveal the rhythmic forms of his own body, and to prove that this rhythm arises from a certain conscious control. Thus, as in the theater in Java and Bali in the old days, it required anywhere from 5 to 15 years of continuous work, constant discipline, to gain the bodily control necessary for the elaborate dance forms of these people. These dance forms were almost completely religious, but they were religious in terms of folk symbolism and myth, as well as in the theological meaning of the word. In these Dutch East Indian areas, which have since proclaimed their independence under the general name of Indonesia, in these areas, the theater came directly into the home. There were very few formal theatrical companies. Plays were put on by members of families, and the theater was an essential part of life. And here is where your mysticism becomes a factor. The individual portraying various characters is expected to release through himself his own understanding of these characters. He is, as far as possible, to revitalize them and be what these characters represent. To do this, he must become receptive to the great symbolisms involved in the mythologies and legendaries of the areas. He finds himself living again the dead heroes of long ago. He feels the heroic spirit stir within himself. And having sensed or actually experienced a certain mood or emotion, he must, through the perfectly disciplined instrument of his body, train precisely to express any and all moods with mathematical accuracy. He must use his body as the musician uses his instrument to become able to reveal in the most certain and definite manner the most abstract and almost incomprehensible reflexes of mind and emotion. This type of discipline is so far beyond Western stage that we hardly know how to compare them. It does not follow, however, that certain individual Western artists have not discovered this. They have. And they are the ones whom we regard with the greatest admiration, because we say they can live their parts. Thus in the dance and in drama, which we know to have been early related, so that drama as we know it arose out of religious pageantry and out of the great ritualistic dances of antiquity. Here we again see mysticism flowing into our way of life. It flows into us as a series of experiences for which we are learning to pay good, hard money. We do not know what we are experiencing, but we still find some experience of this kind necessary to us. Let us imagine then for a moment that you go to a motion picture theater and you are fortunate enough to see something worth seeing. This in itself is a most delightful surprise, but it is conceivable. Let us imagine that you are seeing a truly great dramatic production. If this is true, your relationship to the theater, your relationship to the art medium, and your own relationship to yourself pass through a series of metaphysical changes. In the first place, after the picture becomes important to you, you completely lose sight of the fact that it is a picture. You are not concerned constantly with the technical aspects of camera and angle, unless that happens to be your business. If the picture takes you to some far place, you feel yourself to be there. You are also no longer particularly aware that you are in a theater. You no longer feel that you are sitting with 1,000 other people. The world has ceased. Your own consciousness has become completely absorbed in receiving the impact of this sequence of pictures, which you find completely satisfying or enthralling or arresting in some way. Thus, there gradually comes around the state in which you are alone with a picture. And then gradually, your own identity becomes submerged in the picture. You instinctively identify yourself with the places. For the moment at least, wherever the camera goes, you are there. Whatever time it goes into, you are part of that time. Your own formal nature, as you understand it, becomes unimportant. You do not think of your name or your identity. And while you are watching this picture, you have no imagination as to whether you are old or young, rich or poor. You have created a rapport with something that has moved so closely into your awareness that it has obliterated practically every element outside of itself. If the film or the stage production fail to achieve this, then they have failed in their own peculiar artistry.